there's out there, and then there's homesteading way out there, like Jill Winger and her family in Wyoming. They call themselves the Prairie Homesteader. I've been getting Jill's free Homestead Toolbox newsletter for about a year now. After a bunch of useful tips and honest writing about what works and what doesn't, I think it's time we meet her. Jill Winger, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Alex, I'm thrilled to be here today.
Well, it's cool to have you. So when did you leave city life to pursue your country dream?
Well, so it's been a little bit of a process. I was actually was 18 years old when I decided I was going to leave home and go right to Wyoming. And I really didn't come to Wyoming with the intention of being a homesteader or, you know, being out in the middle of nowhere. I really just came to ride horses. I've always been a horse girl. And so horses brought me to the Wild West, if you want to call it that. And then it kind of morphed into this fascination with country living and buy our own property, and then the rest is history.
Did it take a while to plan out where and how you would do this?
You know, sometimes it does. For some people, you know, I know they do a lot of planning and the process. For us, I kind of like to say we just sort of fell into it. When we were newlyweds, my husband and I, we were looking at properties. He was a city boy as well growing up, and I was raised in town, but we had always wanted to live more rurally than where we were raised. And so we started to look at properties for our first starter home, and we knew we wanted acreage to keep up with my horse habit. And so we found this little chunk of ground, about 67 acres. It had some outbuildings. It was completely run down, just pretty much a mess. And we thought, well, it'll be a project, but it'll be good because we'll have land to keep our horses. And then almost simultaneously, you know, we closed on the property, and I just started becoming obsessed with this idea of what if this property could feed us or create an income for us? Like, what are the possibilities? And I got so excited that I started almost overnight researching things like compost piles and, you know, milk goats and growing vegetables. And yeah, it just progressed from there.
And what would you say the first biggest challenges are when moving to the country, you know?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge, there's lots, just like any adventure, there's lots of things to overcome. But for us, it was becoming overwhelmed because there's so much to focus on at once. And so here we were in this with this tumble down property. We had fence lines to fix. We had roofs on buildings that were falling apart. You know, we were trying to get things set up, and it was deciding what are we going to do first, what's most important, and then being okay with knowing that some of the projects were just going to have to wait and be dealt with later. So it was this balancing act of, you know, we were still working jobs in town, my husband and I both at the time. So we'd work, you know, the normal jobs and try to smash in as many projects as we could on the weekends and the weeknights. And so it was a little bit crazy, especially during those first few years. Things changed moving on, but I know I see a lot of people with similar situations, and they're going, you know, which projects do I do and how do I fit this into my, you know, my modern life, because we all are still in the modern world, or at least most of us are. So there's things to balance.
And, you know, I totally agree, though, with your plan to move forward with something that was really affordable. It's such a mistake when I hear about people who move to the country thinking they're going to pay off a big property debt somehow, and good jobs are few there. So you kind of avoided that pitfall.
We did, yeah. We borrowed, you know, we've always been really passionate about debt-free and living within our means, and that really served us well as we started into this homesteading life. We purchased a property and borrowed far less than what we were approved for, which honestly yielded a property that wasn't super impressive to our friends when we first bought it. And we showed them pictures and they're like, oh, that's nice, because it was pretty ugly. But, you know, it was that sweat equity, and it really paid off because it enabled us to have more capital to put into the projects and not be tied down with a ton of debt.
Yeah, one of the reasons I really like your blog, and one of the reasons I called you, is you have the honesty to admit when it is hard or when things fail. And one example is I don't like weeding. I like to feed my soil, so I do mulch my garden heavily. But I wasn't watching for a serious problem that you warned me about in that heartbreaking blog titled, I Think I Poisoned My Garden. What happened there?
Oh my goodness, it was so sad. So a couple of years ago, I came across this pretty awesome idea of deep mulching. And so it wasn't thought up by me. It was thought up by a woman named Ruth Stout in the 70s. And she would layer her garden with many layers of hay, straw, or similar organic materials and create this amazing cover for the soil. It would feed the soil. It would reduce weeds, and it would reduce the amount of water you needed. So I started to experiment with that method, and I had some really good results for a couple of years. I really choked out a lot of my weeds, so I have less weeding. I stopped tilling for a good, I think there was 3 years, I never had to get the rototiller out. And the soil would be soft and spongy, it was full of worms, and it just was awesome. So I went along my merry way. I would get hay from local growers, and it was usually older hay, and I'd put, you know, put the old stale hay on the garden. And then last year, I noticed that a lot of my plants were really looking stunted, especially my tomatoes. They had this bizarre curling of the leaves, and they weren't dying, and they weren't dried out, or it wasn't like they were burned by compost or, you know, dehydrated, like some of the issues we might think of first when something happens in the garden. So I started to research a little bit and look at the symptoms of some of my plants, and I realized that the hay I had been using, unbeknownst to me, had been sprayed in its lifetime at some point with a type of herbicide in the aminopyrrolid family. And I had never heard of that before. It's a crazy, you know, crazy word. I had to totally acquaint myself with that. But in essence, those herbicides last for a very long time on hay. They're a broadleaf herbicide, so it doesn't hurt the grass it's sprayed on, but it will kill any broadleaf weeds that it comes in contact with. And it lasts a long time. It can actually even go through the digestive tracts of animals. So if you feed an animal sprayed hay and then you put their composted manure on your garden, you could potentially have issues there. So I pretty much ruined the garden last year. It was a tough lesson. We're regrouping now. I think we're going to try some raised beds and be very, very careful with what we put in the beds from here on out. But it was, yeah, it was hard. It was definitely a big fail in the garden last year.
Well, I just got a big bale of straw delivered, and it was all compressed, and it's worked great. But I didn't have a check for that, and now anything I get from here on in, I'm going to ask for sure what's been on this.
Absolutely.
You also wrote an article called, I'm Teaching My Kids to Fail, and that sounds so counterintuitive. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, it is a little counterintuitive, especially in our culture these days. And it's all about, you know, participation trophies and things like that. But in my own journey, especially as like a business owner and an entrepreneur, I've learned that some of my biggest successes usually come on the heels of a big failure. And I really started to become fascinated with that concept because I've noticed in myself or with people that I work with, a lot of times it's really tempting to just want to quit. You know, you mess something up, you fail, you embarrass yourself, and it's really tempting to say, you know, I wasn't meant to do that. It wasn't meant for me. I'm going to just cut my losses and move on. And I've realized that so many times looking back, if I had done that at those points in my life where I did fail, that I would have missed out on some of my greatest successes. And so I've really started to apply that with my kids. And of course, it's hard as a parent because they're our kids and we want to protect them and we want to shelter them from hard things in life. But so it's a little bit of a balance. You have to use common sense. But I really have been conscious of letting my kids try and sometimes letting them feel the failure and letting them know that's okay. It's something that is natural, it's normal, and even celebrating the failure sometimes. But it's not a thing to be scared of. It's just a part of the process. And I really feel like if you're not failing, you're not trying hard enough sometimes.
I got to agree with you totally. And speaking of kids, it's hard to realize that they may not choose the same lifestyle when they get older. It's so true. My own daughter spent her youngest years on our big homestead, and later she lived in the city. But more recently, she moved back to a small town and back to raising food and permaculture and all that. So we don't know how much sticks with our kids, but it may be a lot. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's my goal is to pass along the principles that make homesteading so special to us. You know, the principles of hard work, of being confident, of trying, of understanding failure is not permanent. And, you know, I think about that a lot because my husband and I both went completely opposite directions than our parents did. So I often wonder, you know, what if my kids do the same? They go the complete opposite direction that we did and say, see, Mom and Dad, we're going to New York and we're going to make our way in the big city. And you know, if that's what they're called to do, I'm okay with that. I just hope and pray that the lessons they've learned here on the homestead, the work ethic, the integrity, as long as they take those with them, I'm okay with that.
My wife and I used to joke about that. We thought maybe we should wear suits and ties and tell our kids we were accountants so that they would do the opposite. But anyway.
Exactly.
Well, One thing I did notice, though, is when we lived in the country, as the kids got older, getting into high school, the parents ended up like a taxi service. Kids want to play sports. They want to participate. They want to go all sorts of places. So that's a stage you may have to look forward to where you are.
That's something we're kind of gearing up for. Our oldest is only six, so we have a little bit of time, but it is important for us for them to be involved in things like 4-H or sports or other activities. So I imagine we are going to be on the road more here in the future.
And there may be an arc of age when it comes to homesteading. Once a homestead's set up and operating, some people do stay there well into their old age. I knew an older woman, 84, looking after cows by herself. But to set one up, as you and your husband did, it really needs younger people, I think, so that maybe we need a kind of guide for homesteading for seniors. You know, what are the boundaries? What are you really going to be able to do? How can you get back to the country?
You know, I think that all ages can do this. I do have readers that are definitely older than I am that are doing this successfully. But I think, like you said, I think it might be one of those things where you maybe purchase something that's a little more established. You're not out there having to drill post holes and pack around hay bales and things. And, you know, there's lots of things like chickens or raised beds, gardens, and things along those lines that aren't quite as labor intensive. So I think it can be done, just maybe in a different version.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, we're trying it. We're back in the country and we'll see how it goes.
Radio EcoShock.
So this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with the prairie homesteader, Jill Winger. I liked your tips on chickens and chicken coops. You know, even some vegetarians realize it's good to get protein from chicken eggs. But here's my question. Can we have chickens without buying big bags of feed from some industrial supplier?
Well, yes and no, depending on who you talk to. First off, I say yes because chickens have been kept for hundreds of years without big box feed stores. So it is possible. It's not sometimes as simple as people think that you can just turn them out to free range any old place and expect the chickens to produce optimally. And sometimes if we do have these breeds who have been bred for maximum egg production or maximum meat production, they do need a special diet to help them live to their potential. You know, I think I like to do a little bit of a hybrid. We do purchase a custom mix organic feed from a local feed store, and we give our flock that. But we also like to free range them when we can and give them scraps from the kitchen or leftover milk from the cow. And so we do a little bit of both, and that does cut down our feed bill. But it does ensure also they are getting those nutrients they need. Because I know at least here in Wyoming, there's a lot of months out of the year. There's not a lot of bugs. There's not a lot of foliage. And if I just expected them to free range and forage the entire year, we'd have some issues.
You certainly would. There's a few predators might be out there too.
Yes, we do have predator problems on occasion.
All right, now here's another topic that I really didn't know much about, and in fact, I'm only getting into it a bit because of your blog. So tell us, what is an essential oil and why are you so into it?
Yeah, great question. So essential oil is basically a steam distilled plant, and not all plants can become essential oils, but many of them do have enough of those volatile oils in the plant matter that they can be distilled, and then those oils can then be put into a bottle and we can use them in that concentrated form. And so I started using essential oils about 5 years ago, and I really was looking at them more for ways to support my family's health. So, you know, I like natural things. I like things from the earth, things from plants that really fits with my homesteader mentality. So I looked at these little bottles of basically, you know, plant extract, but steam distilled, and I thought, this is pretty intriguing. And, you know, fast forward to where we are now, and I use essential oils daily on the homestead. They really come in handy. We're far from town. It's not easy to run to the store if one of us is under the weather, and so it's very handy to have them to support health with my kids or myself or my husband when we need them. And I use them on the animals, too. I make fly sprays, garden sprays. We make little salves for animals who might have some skin issues. And so they're very, very handy. They're compact. I feel like they're very cost-effective because a little bottle goes a really long way. So I think it's a really awesome homesteader tool.
Are you making them? Are you selling them? What's your relationship with them now?
I don't make them because it's really quite the process. It takes a lot of raw plant matter to make a tiny bit of oil. So it's kind of beyond my scope. But I do work with a company I love, and I am a distributor. So I get to work with a lot of different people and help them learn to use the oils on their homesteads and their families and so on.
Have you published any books?
I do. I do have an ebook that's actually free. about essential oils, but that's accessible on the blog for anybody who's interested.
Cool. Well, you know, the internet changes the whole dynamics of making a living in the country. My wife works from our rural home, and I can do my radio program from outside the big city. I'm blessed to be able to just look out and look at these gigantic hills around me. How are you using social media and the net?
You know, when we first started the homestead, I worked in town, my husband worked in town, and it really was our intention that that would be the way life would go, because that's just how it works, right? Actually, when I started the blog, it was begun with the intention of being a journal of our life, but it started to take off. I started to really invest time and energy into it, and it started to create an income. I was providing value to people, and they were wanting to buy books that I was publishing or products I was promoting, and so it was kind of awesome to have that income flow in. And so I kept at it. It was kind of a process, but where we are today is my husband now is home with a family full time, and I work from home. And the blog and our essential oil business, actually, they support us full time, and they've allowed us to really take our goals and dreams to the next level and accomplish things a lot faster than we had ever planned. So it's awesome to be able to live our dream life, you know, here on the property, here with our animals, and then to be able to create that income here all at the same time.
All right. Now, Jill, who do you think your audience is? Is it more women, more men, people already in the country, or people who are dreaming of getting out of the city? What do you think?
I have a little bit of everything, but definitely more women who are dreaming, I think, or maybe who have started a garden in their backyard or have a chicken or two and are ready to kind of dive in a little deeper. Those are the bulk of my audience, I believe.
And people think of Wyoming as kind of a harsh place at times. Sure, it's big sky country, but isn't it also a tough environment to get by it?
It is. It's not what I would call your perfect homesteading mecca. It's definitely a little rugged sometimes. Yeah, so people often, you know, also I'll post pictures that look really romantic or pretty, and they'll email me and say, I want to move to Wyoming. And I'm like, oh, wait, because it's not really the most easy place to homestead, but it can be done. I think it can be done everywhere if you're willing to adapt. So here in Wyoming, we have to deal with harsh winters, wind, and snow, but we still get the job done. We just have to take some things into consideration.
Tell us about the weekly Homestead Toolbox newsletter.
So I started that a couple years ago, and it's really been a hit. People can sign up for the newsletter for free through the blog, and then every Wednesday morning, I send out a short email that has 4 to 5 little bites of homestead information. So I know everyone's really busy, and so I know I don't like to read super long emails, and so I keep mine pretty short. But you can expect to find little recipes, tutorials, little tidbits about what we're doing that week on our homestead, and just little things to kind of, the toolbox, right, just to keep people moving forward in their dreams and giving them the practical tools that they need. So it's been really fun. People have been very receptive towards it.
Well, when we moved from the city to the country, I found that neighbors were an essential lifeline for country living, and I learned some of my survival skills just from the people who had already been there for a long time, some of the older families. How is your relationship with the local community?
Yeah, we have awesome neighbors. And so we don't have a ton of necessarily people I would call homesteaders here, but we have a lot of farmers and ranchers who make their living farming and ranching, and so they're amazing resources. And we definitely depend on our neighbors a lot for things like helping us with chores, helping us with cattle projects and things like that. So I feel like that's a huge benefit of country living, to be able to tap into that. It's a different atmosphere than I remember neighbors growing up in our neighborhood, you know, as a child. Just a different dynamic. And our neighbors are sometimes 15, 20 miles away, but we still call them neighbors, and they're the people we call if we're in a bind. And so I love that part of this lifestyle. It's really that old-fashioned camaraderie.
And the National Weather Service is predicting a hot, dry summer ahead. How's your water supply?
It can be rough sometimes, and we've had our drought years for sure. Our wells usually do okay, but there is definitely years where I'll stop watering the lawn and things get pretty brown, and we just keep the garden going, and that's about it. So hopefully, you know, we're kind of dry right now, but we usually get some good moisture in April and May, so my fingers are crossed.
I put a big water tank next to our house, and we collect everything off the eaves, and that's working out pretty well.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it didn't cost that much. It was just a used tank, and it's clean, water safe. Anyway, so like your homestead is 45 miles from the nearest grocery store. How does that change the dynamics of bulk purchasing, home food storage, and canning and all that?
So we definitely buy things in bulk. beside the fact that the store is a ways away, I don't like going to town usually. So I try to avoid frequent trips. But yeah, I buy things in bulk. And I love to make things myself. So at any given time, I have lots of ingredients, but not a lot of prepackaged food, which is just how we're used to living. And I think it's actually made me a better cook because, you know, if we get a craving for something like ice cream or pizza, we can't just run to the store and get it. We have to figure out how to make it ourselves from sometimes creative ingredients. And so I think it's helped my culinary skills a little bit to be so isolated.
Jill, what's your view of how society is going? Do you want to be prepared in case the economy goes bad?
Yeah, we do think of that sometimes. I think there are some things we could do personally to improve our preparedness, but we do have some things in place. We do. My husband and I do have those conversations frequently of, you know, being aware and being prepared. You never know. There's lots of what-ifs out there.
I like to be prepared, but I like to think, too, that I'm just doing what I love to do anyway. So if the economy goes really great, fine. I'm enjoying my gardening. And if it doesn't, well, we can supplement our food bill tremendously.
Exactly. And that's our thoughts. You know, I wouldn't be doing this if it was just out of a place of, you know, we have to do it to get ready for whatever's going to happen. I don't think I would enjoy it. But we do it from a place of this is what we love. This is our quality of life. And if it helps us be more prepared in the process, even better.
Well, you have a lot going. Do you have some new projects in mind?
Yes, I'm actually working on a big project. I can't quite say what it is yet, but it's something that people have been requesting for a while. So it's in the works. It'll be a big project for this year, but I'm really ready to present that to everyone.
All right. And I know you do some speaking around the country. What sort of topics do you cover when you go out there?
Generally, when I travel for speaking, it's about essential oils. And that's my most common topic. We talk about oils for homesteading and oils for, you know, home remedies and things like that. But I do leave the homestead every once in a while. And yeah, I do some traveling with that. It's pretty fun.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners? Maybe I've missed something or another topic you're really interested in.
I think we covered everything well. Just a little bit of encouragement that if anyone's out there and they've been dreaming about chickens or mason jars or canning, just dive in. And I especially encourage people not to wait till the time is perfect because there'll never be the perfect time. So if you're drawn to that, you're called to that, figure out what you can do now to start getting moving towards your goals and just take those little baby steps. It's really rewarding. And I think people are usually surprised at how much they'll learn in the process.
Yeah, I think one way to approach that, too, is to consider renting. There's a lot of places for rent in the country. You can try it out, see how you're doing, and then figure out from there where a good place for you might be.
Absolutely, yes.
I've been talking with Jill Winger, and from her 67-acre patch of Wyoming, Jill tells us about their family adventures on the Prairie Homestead. And you can find out more at theprairiehomestead.com. And their Homestead Toolbox newsletter is free. It's useful. It doesn't overload my inbox. So you can sign up at the site. And you'll find more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Jill, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.